they had wanted to talk about their work, they would have found it difficult to find someone outside of the lab who would understand what they were talking about. Off campus, people around town often found the Langley employees a bit peculiar. They had strange accents from other parts of the country. Many of them wore rumpled shirts with no ties, and some wore sandals or sported beards. Locals called them brainbusters or NACA nuts. The less polite called them weirdos. What makes things fly? The pace of discovery and invention was so fast at Langley that an entry-level position there was considered by many people to be like studying at the world's best engineering school. In addition to receiving on-the-job training, employees had the chance to take classes in math and physics and other subjects that would help them further understand how to design better planes. And that's what Dorothy did. With the goal of turning women math teachers into crack junior engineers, the laboratory sponsored a crash course in engineering physics for the newly arrived computers. 2 days a week after work, Dorothy Vaughn and the other new mathematicians filed into a makeshift classroom at the laboratory for an intensive class in the fundamental theory of aerodynamics, which is the study of objects moving through the air. They also attended a weekly 2-hour laboratory session for hands-on training in one of the wind tunnels, and they had an average of 4 hours of homework on top of their 6-day work week. What makes things fly? Dorothy asked herself all day long at her new job. She had never flown on a plane and had never before given much thought to the question. The first course she took at Langley taught her the basics of aerodynamics. She learned that when a wing moves through the air gets cut into two parts. There is slower moving airflow on the bottom of the wing and faster moving airflow on the top. This creates two different pressures, and it's this difference in pressure that creates lift, the almost magical force that causes the wing and the plane attached to it to rise into the sky. It's important to keep air smoothly flowing around the plane. Turbulence or sudden gusts of wind can make a plane hard to control. One of the NACA's greatest achievements was designing wings that allowed planes to move easily through the air. Today we take many of these design elements for granted, but each change came about after a series of experiments and mathematical computations, and luck. The first inventors made some assumptions, built a plane, tried to fly it, and if they didn't die in the process, they applied what they learned to the next attempt. By the time Dorothy was on the job, the task of modifying airplane design had been turned over to the aeronautical engineers and the test pilots, who flew the planes directly into their weak spots. Each time the pilots pushed the aircraft to the limit, they helped generate data that could be used to identify ways to make a good plane even better. The test pilots also risked their lives and the loss of a very expensive piece of equipment. To make the job easier, researchers developed wind tunnels that allowed them to test model planes without the danger of flying a real plane. At its simplest, a wind tunnel was a big box attached to a powerful fan. The basic idea behind the wind tunnel was that air moving at a certain speed over a stationary object was similar to moving the object through the air at the same speed. Engineers blasted air over full-sized aircraft, scale models, or individual parts, such as wings or bodies. By closely observing how the air flowed around the object, the engineers could assess how the object would fly through the air. Langley built different wind tunnels to test specific features of the planes. There was even a tunnel called the full-scale tunnel, which opened wide enough to swallow a full-sized plane. Running the electricity-hungry wind tunnels wasn't always easy for the laboratory because the local power company rationed electricity during the war, including for the laboratory. The NACA solved the problem by running some of their tests into the wee hours and people living near Langley complained about the roar of the tunnels while they were trying to sleep. Despite the challenges, building wind tunnels that were quite similar to real-world conditions was one of the keys to the NACA's success. Making a good plane better. No organization came close to Langley in the quality and range of wind tunnel research data. It wasn't good enough to say a plane flew well or badly. Engineers tried to measure how a plane performed, so they developed a 9-page checklist. These experiments generated data, numbers, lots and lots of numbers, and the raw data from the tests then went to the desks of Dorothy Vaughan and the other female computers for analysis. An airplane wasn't one machine for a single purpose. It was a complex machine that could be tweaked to perform different kinds of tasks. The airplane names or designations reflected their use. Fighters, also called pursuit planes, were assigned the letter F or the letter P. The letter C identified cargo planes, which were built to transport military goods and troops. B was for bombers, and X marked the spot of experimental planes still in development. Planes lost their X designation once they went into production. For example, the B-29 was the final version of the XB-29. Engineers worked hard to make each version of an aircraft better and more stable than the previous one. Discoveries, large and small, contributed to the speed, maneuverability, and safety of the machines. As World War II approached its peak in 1945, almost every American military airplane being produced in factories had features that were based on the research results and recommendations of the NACA. Whether data came from the wind tunnels, test flights, or theoretical models, it eventually reached the women computers so they could use their sharp pencils and sharp minds to figure out what the numbers meant. Instead of looking at just a few numbers, they looked at extremely large sets of numbers, which could be used to find patterns or trends in the ways the airplanes performed. What Dorothy and the other women at the laboratory worked on was usually a small portion of a larger task. The work was carved up into smaller pieces for quick, efficient, and accurate processing. By the time the work arrived on the computer's desks, it might be just a set of equations and numbers. Sometimes they didn't even know what kind of plane had been tested or what the engineers were hoping to understand from their research. Once a woman finished a particular job, the calculations were taken to the engineers, who used them to improve airplane designs. The computer's work was essential, but largely uncelebrated. "Woe unto thee if they shall make thee a computer," joked a column in AirScoop, "for the project engineer will take credit for whatsoever thou doth that is clever and full of glory. But if he slippeth up and maketh the wrong calculation, he shall lay the mistake at thy door when he is called to account, and he shall say, 'What can you expect from girl computers anyway?'" But sometimes a breakthrough was so important that everyone got credit. When the Boeing B-29 Superfortress was finished, it became a symbol of United States technological progress and its ability to bring destruction to its enemies. There is no one in the laboratory who should feel that he or she did not have a part in the bombing of Japan, the NACA director said to the lab employees. "The engineers who assisted, the mechanics and model makers who did their share, the computers who worked up the data, the secretaries who typed and retyped the results, and the janitors and maids who kept the tunnel clean and suitable for work, all made their contribution to the final bombing of Japan." Dorothy knew that her work was making a difference in the outcome of the war. She read the news accounts of how the B-29s, capable of flying farther, faster, and with a heavier bomb load than any plane in history, dropped precision bombs over Japan from high in the sky. Dorothy found her work more intense and interesting than she had imagined, and she knew she wanted to stay for the duration of the war, and maybe longer. There was no doubt about it. Dorothy Vaughan had become one of the NACA nuts. Chapter 8. The Duration. Though Dorothy Vaughan loved her new job in Hampton and was proud to be helping her country with the war effort, she missed her children terribly. She sometimes worked 18-hour days, and the demands of her job made it difficult for her to get home except for during holidays. And it seemed like the minute she walked through the door at the family house back in Farmville, it was time for her to turn around and head back to Newport News. When she could go home, the back-and-forth lifestyle was taking a toll. Dorothy wanted something more permanent. Like most of the computers at the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory, Dorothy was a temporary War Service employee. She didn't know when or if the laboratory would offer her a permanent job. Dorothy knew what she wanted her future to look like, so in July 1944, she signed a lease on a new two-bedroom apartment in Newsome Park. Dorothy wanted her children eventually to live with her for good in Newport News. This two-bedroom apartment would be a start. But finding the right house hadn't been easy. There weren't enough homes available to meet the demands of the growing African-American population. Dorothy chose a neighborhood near where she had been living for the previous 9 months. It included black families from all income levels. Domestic workers lived next to doctors, lawyers next to laborers, small business owners next to civil servant mathematicians. All were welcome. Dorothy's new home was identical to the 1,199 others that had been built in the same subdivision. Newsome Park was also designed to keep morale high among the wartime workers who had to work long hours under stressful conditions. The Newsome Park residents loved that their neighborhood had a community center with a kitchen and banquet space, rooms for club meetings and basketball and tennis courts. They even had a baseball diamond. And the shopping center included a grocery store, drugstore, barbershop, beauty parlor, cleaners, and a TV repair shop. A nursery school and a new elementary school were in walking distance from her new apartment. Dorothy's mother-in-law tried to discourage the move. "You're not going to take my babies," she said to Dorothy. Dorothy appreciated her mother-in-law's help all the months she'd been away, but now she needed her children to be close to her. A year after Dorothy left Farmville, her children moved into the apartment in Newsome Park. They started at Newsome Park Elementary School in the fall of 1944. Her husband continued to travel with his job as a bellman. He came down to visit when he could, but he didn't stay long. Victory over Japan. By 1945, 5 out of 10 people in southeastern Virginia worked for the government. Housing development sprawled for miles. The community was built around the business of war, but people were starting to wonder what a defense industry boomtown would become during a time of peace. The answer came on VJ Day, Victory over Japan Day. On August 14, 1945, at 7 p.m., newscasters announced that World War II was over. All over town, soldiers and civilians streamed into the streets. Business owners locked their doors and joined the celebrations that went on through the night. People paraded down the streets and workers held hands to form human chains as they danced around cars. Makeshift confetti rained down from windows onto the streets below. But after the initial celebrations and parties, uncertainty settled in. 3 weeks after VJ Day, the Norfolk Journal and Guide reported layoffs of 1,500 Newport News shipyard workers and a decrease for women workers, both white and colored. Returning servicemen were expected to have first claim on the jobs that remained in the peacetime economy. With the return of the men who had been fighting overseas, the demand for women workers dropped. 2 million American women, black and white alike, received pink slips or notices that they were losing their jobs, even before the war officially ended. Some women looked forward to going home. Others enjoyed their jobs and their paychecks, and they didn't want to go back to the traditional female roles in the kitchen and nursery. Many husbands will return home to find that the helpless little wives they left behind have become grown, independent women, wrote a female columnist in the Norfolk Journal and Guide. Post-war prejudice. Almost immediately after VJ Day, some employers returned to their policies of not hiring African Americans. With the labor market changing, the dream that many black leaders had of establishing permanent economic opportunity began to slip away. No one was more opposed to opening hiring policies to African Americans than Virginia's Democratic Senator, Harry Byrd, who called the policy the most dangerous idea ever seriously considered. Byrd's family had built a newspaper and apple-growing fortune, and he treated segregation as a religion. He ran a political machine that kept the poor of all races divided against one another. Dorothy, like so many of the others who had come to Hampton Roads during the war, didn't want to return to her former life. She assumed that she was going to keep her job and continue with her new life. It wasn't a risk-free bet. Dorothy committed to the lease on the apartment in Newsome Park before Langley converted her wartime employee status to that of permanent civil service employee. She didn't want to wait to put down roots in her new home, even though it soon became apparent that losing the apartment was still a possibility. Dorothy and the others who lived in her neighborhood learned that some local officials wanted to demolish Newsome Park and redevelop the neighborhood. And federal authorities planned to pry the houses off their foundations and send them to war-devastated populations in Europe. The residents went back and forth with the government over the status of their neighborhood, which they had come to love. The government said that Newsome Park was not temporary in character, yet not permanent in its current location. Though they lived in a state of limbo, the people of Newsome Park were determined to do everything they could to keep their community alive. Life in Newport News was an adjustment for Dorothy's children, who missed their small-town freedom and the space at the big house in Farmville. But as the months passed, the family settled in. Dorothy had become quite close to her fellow West computer, Miriam Mann. They were friends both at work and at home, and their families had become like one large extended family. When Dorothy and Miriam learned that the famous African-American singer Marian Anderson was going to perform at Hampton Institute, the women made plans for their families to go together. On the day of the performance, Dorothy looked over at her children, who were entranced by Anderson's beautiful voice. Dorothy knew this moment was one her family would never forget. She knew they were home. Chapter 9. Breaking Barriers. Dorothy Vaughn and her husband saw each other on holidays and occasional weekends. They added two more children to their family, and for the younger ones, Newsome Park was the only home they knew. Dorothy loved staying home to take care of the new babies, but there was never a question that she would return to work as soon as possible after the children were old enough to stay with a babysitter. Dorothy's job at Langley provided the economic stability for the family. While Dorothy and her children missed their family back in Farmville, friends from the West Computing Office filled the void left by aunts and uncles and cousins. The group from West Computing began a summertime tradition of organizing a picnic at Log Cabin Beach, a wooded resort overlooking the James River, a segregated beach built exclusively for black people. Dorothy preferred Log Cabin Beach to Bayshore Beach in Hampton, where a rope divided Bayshore from whites-only Buckrow Beach next door. At Log Cabin, black families were able to enjoy being outside without colored signs to remind them of their place. Dorothy earned a good salary, $2,400 a year, twice the average monthly wage for black women in the 1940s. When the laboratory operated on a 24-hour schedule during the war, Dorothy had worked the 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. shift, taking care of her family by day and crunching numbers at night. Most of the other West computers also decided to keep their jobs. The section had outgrown its original room in the warehouse building, and in 1945 they moved to two spacious offices on the first floor of the newly built Aircraft Loads Division building. But providing for the needs of six children meant that vacations didn't come along often. Dorothy was frugal. She sewed clothes for herself and her children, clipped coupons, and wore shoes until her feet pushed through the worn soles. She sacrificed for her children. Many evenings, Dorothy came home from work and made dinner for the family. After putting the meal on the table, she walked around the block until the children were done eating. She then ate only the leftovers. She didn't want to eat before she knew that her little ones had eaten all that they needed. A permanent job. The prediction that the end of the war would destroy the economy of the Hampton Roads area proved incorrect. A defense industry boom followed the war, and it lasted decades. Hampton Roads became a military capital. After the war, the Norfolk Naval Base was established as the headquarters of the Navy's Air Command. Next came the Army Transportation School in Newport News and the U.S. Coast Guard Base in Portsmouth. In 1946, the Army decided to make Langley Field the headquarters of its Tactical Air Command. And then, the following year, the Army Air Corps became an independent branch of the military known as the United States Air Force. The number of people working at Langley dropped immediately after the war. Most people left voluntarily, choosing to retire or take other work. Many women computers left to return home or marry men they had worked with. Engagement and wedding announcements filled the pages of the employee newsletter Air Scoop. Another popular newsletter feature was Air Mail, a listing of birth announcements. The women had to figure out how to balance the demands of family and work on a long-term basis. Some women took time off to take care of their babies, while others quit their jobs altogether. But with the airplane growing ever more important to America's economy and its military, it seemed like Langley might always need talented computers. In 1947, the laboratory disbanded the East Computing Pool and sent the white women who had been working in that office to work in specific wind tunnels. All of East Computing's assignments were reassigned to West Computing. With the added work, West Computing remained in high gear. It wasn't surprising that Langley wanted to keep Dorothy Vaughn on as a computer. In 3 years, she had proven herself by handing in error-free work and managing deadlines without complaint. She earned excellent ratings from her bosses and had been promoted to shift supervisor, managing one-third of a group that was now made up of 25 women. Specialization. Men often came to the laboratory as junior engineers and were allowed to design and conduct their own experiments. Researchers took the men under their wings, teaching them the ropes. Women, on the other hand, had to work much harder to overcome other people's low expectations. A woman who worked in the central computing pool was one step removed from the research, and the engineer's assignments sometimes lacked the context to give the computer much knowledge about the project. The work of most of the women was anonymous. Even a woman who had worked closely with an engineer on a research report rarely saw her name on the final publication. The engineers assumed it didn't matter. After all, she was just a woman, and many of the men were blind to the fact that a woman might have the same ambitions as a man. Sometimes a computer's work impressed an engineer so much that he invited her to join him working full-time with a wind tunnel group. For the women, this meant an opportunity to get closer to the research and perhaps specialize in a particular subfield of aeronautics. A computer who could not only process data but also understand how to interpret it was more valuable to the team than a pool computer with more general knowledge. Specialization became the key to managing the increasingly complex nature of aeronautical research in the post-war era. Sonic boom. Many of the Langley engineers shared a dream. They wanted to design an aircraft capable of flying faster than the speed of sound. And the women at Langley were no exception. They dreamed of this exciting possibility, which was seeming less far-fetched by the day. To pursue this dream, in 1947, a group of 13 employees, including two former East computers, were sent to the Mojave Desert in the western part of the United States to establish a high-speed flight research center. Their mission? To build the fastest airplane in the world, one that could fly faster than the speed of sound. The speed of sound is about 760 miles per hour. The exact number varies depending on temperature, altitude, and humidity. Scientists used to think that flying faster than the speed of sound was impossible, but they were wrong. Mach 1 is the term for something moving at the speed of sound. When an object is moving this fast, the air molecules in front of the object can't get out of the way quickly enough, so they become compressed and form a shock wave. That shockwave is the noise we hear from the crack of a bullwhip or the firing of a bullet. Scientists weren't sure what would happen to a pilot or his plane if he flew at Mach 1. Some researchers thought that the plane or the pilot would be destroyed by the power of the shockwave. Others disagreed. There was only one way to find out. Try it. On October 14, 1947, pilot Chuck Yeager flew over the Mojave Desert in an NACA-developed experimental research plane called the Bell X-1, and he pierced the sound barrier for the first time in history. The plane caused a loud noise, a sonic boom, just like the shock wave from the bullet and the bullwhip, but the pilot and the plane were safe. The female computers on the ground verified the data transmitted from the instruments attached to the X-1 on its record-breaking flight. At the Mojave Desert facility, the computers who helped with this experiment had the chance to do significant work and get credit for it. They were promoted from computer to the higher position of junior engineer and were named as the authors of research reports, a necessary first step in the career of an engineer. And for a woman, it was an extraordinary achievement. It meant that the whole world would see that she had contributed to a worthy piece of research and that she was an important member of an engineering team. Dorothy Hoover, another black woman who worked in West Computing, was the first African-American woman to leave the computing pool and get a chance at a research job, working directly for an engineer. She had earned an undergraduate degree in math from Arkansas Agricultural Mechanical and Normal College and a master's degree in mathematics from Atlanta University, and she taught in three states before coming to Langley in 1943. She was excellent at abstract concepts and complex equations. She had been assigned many of the most challenging problems and always submitted flawless work. As a talented mathematician with an independent mind, Dorothy Hoover was a perfect addition to any research team. Her visibility with engineers increased with her promotion. She answered the computer's questions and understood complex math so well that she sometimes knew more than many of the engineers in the lab. The section leader. Dorothy Vaughan was an excellent leader within the West Area computing pool. In 1947, one of her bosses got sick and was out of the office for a month. The next year, the boss fell ill again. Then in early 1949, Dorothy's boss began to act strangely at work. She suffered a mental breakdown and was forced to leave her job. This tragic incident left the computing pool without a leader, but the engineers at the laboratory decided to choose Dorothy to be the temporary head of the entire section. This was the first time an African-American woman had been assigned a management role at Langley. At the time, it was unthinkable for a man to report to a woman. men were always ultimately the people in charge. Women who had an interest in management were limited to heading a section in one of the computing pools or a division with female workers, but they always reported to a man. For Dorothy, the new job was a lot like being at the head of a high school classroom and reporting to a principal, who was usually a man. It would take Dorothy Vaughn 2 years to earn the full title of section head. The men she worked for held her in limbo. The laboratory had never had a black supervisor before, and they may have delayed making what seemed like a groundbreaking decision. Dorothy, however, was patient. Her promotion was made official when a memo circulated in January 1951. Effective this date, Dorothy J. Vaughn, who has been acting head of West Area Computers Unit, is hereby appointed head of that unit. Dorothy took on the new responsibilities with confidence. Many of the women in West Computing knew she was the best candidate, and so did many engineers. In time, her bosses realized it too. History would prove them all right. There was no one better qualified for the job than Dorothy Vaughn. Chapter 10. No Limits. In April 1951, a few months after Dorothy Vaughn became the boss of the West Area Computing Pool, 26-year-old Mary Winston Jackson came to work for her. Mary was new to the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory, but not new to the area. Mary and her family had deep roots in Hampton, Virginia. She grew up listening to the work songs of the black women shucking oysters at the processing plant in town. As a child, she heard elders at the black churches in town telling stories about sitting under a large oak tree across the river and listening to the Union soldiers read the Emancipation Proclamation. The edict issued by Abraham Lincoln in 1863, during the Civil War, which freed the slaves in the South. Mary went to school in Hampton. In 1938, she graduated from Phoenix High School with highest honors. She enrolled at Hampton Institute, where she pledged Alpha Kappa Alpha, the same black sorority that Dorothy Vaughn and many of the other West Computers had joined when they were in college. Most of Hampton Institute's female students earned degrees in home economics or nursing, but Mary studied mathematics and physical science. After graduation, she took a teaching job in Maryland. The following year, her father became sick, and she returned to Hampton to help care for him. Back home, she took a position at a community center run by the United Services Organization, USO, a nonprofit group that provides services and entertainment to United States soldiers. She helped military families and defense workers find places to live, played the piano during sing-alongs, and helped organize Girl Scout troop meetings and rallies. At one of the USO dances, Mary met Levi Jackson, an enlistee at the Naval School run by the Hampton Institute. They fell in love and married in 1944. Always an independent-minded woman, Mary passed up the all-white bridal gown for a shorter white dress with black sequins, accessorized with black gloves, black pumps, and a red rose corsage. Mary Winston, now Mary Jackson, did things her own way. Raising expectations. When World War II ended, Levi Jackson found work as a painter at Langley Field. The USO closed, and Mary searched for a new job. She worked briefly as a bookkeeper, but left after the birth of her son. For a while, she was a busy stay-at-home mom. Even though taking care of her son kept her busy, Mary always found time for activities that made her happy. One of the things she loved the most was leading Girl Scout Troop 11, which was affiliated with her church. The organization's commitment to preparing women to take their place in the world with a mission of respect for God and country, and of honesty and loyalty, embodied Mary's core beliefs. She took the girls on three-mile hikes and field trips to the crab factory to learn more about what their parents did for work. She took them to an afternoon tea at the Hampton Institute Mansion House, where the college's president and his family lived. For the first time in history, Hampton Institute's president was black. The grand president's residence was occupied by a black family. It was a sight the girls never forgot, an impeccable black staff in a fabulous house serving a black family. Mary Jackson understood how impressionable the young girls were. At a troop meeting, the group sang the folk tune Pick a Bale of Cotton. It was a well-known song that she had sung countless times before. But that day, it was as if she heard the words for the first time. We're gonna jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton. She realized it was talking about slavery times in the South, and she didn't want to keep that idea alive. Hold on a minute, she interrupted. We are never going to sing this again. She explained that the song reinforced all the worst stereotypes about what it meant to be black. She told the girls they could be much more than that. Maybe Mary couldn't remove the limits that society put on the girls, but it was her duty to try to make sure the girls didn't put limits on themselves. Their dark skin, their gender, their economic status, none of these were reasons not to live out their dreams. You can do better, we can do better, she told them every day. For Mary Jackson, life was a long process of raising one's expectations. Working at Langley. When her son turned 4, Mary Jackson filled out an application with the civil service, applying both for a secretarial position and also for a job as a computer at Langley. In January 1951, she was hired as a secretary at Fort Monroe, an army base in Hampton. She was required to get a security clearance because of the documents she handled working for military officers. Following World War II, the United States had become anxious about the threat posed by the Soviet Union. Though the two countries had been allies during the war, their relationship was less friendly, especially after the Soviet Union detonated its first atomic bomb. The United States and the Soviet Union didn't trust one another. Then word spread that the Soviet Union had flown planes over Korea in 1950 that were too fast to be identified. A headline in the 1950 Norfolk Journal and Guide read, "Russia said to have fastest fighter plane." The United States had just assumed that it ruled the skies with its fast and powerful fleet of airplanes. After all, the country had led the way through the sound barrier with Chuck Yeager in 1947. By 1950, however, the NACA estimated that the Russians expended at least 3 times the manpower in their research establishments compared to what the United States budgeted. The National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics asked Congress for a larger budget, and eventually Langley started hiring again. The long list of job openings published in Air Scoop was similar to those of the boom time during the war. America had no intention of backing down or surrendering the skies to any other country. Given Mary Jackson's background in mathematics, it came as no surprise that the government offered her a job working at Langley. Mary resigned from her job at the Army base and went to work for Dorothy Vaughan. No speed limits. The NACA engineers had successfully broken the sound barrier, but they knew that in order to stay ahead of the Russians, they had to build even faster planes, not just experimental aircraft, but ones that could be put into production for the military. For America to continue its present challenged supremacy in the air will require that it develop tactical military aircraft that will fly faster than sound before any other nation does so, the NACA's executive secretary said in the Norfolk Journal and Guide. Mach 1 was just the beginning. Engineers and pilots dreamed of flying with no speed limits. Some engineers imagined a day when pilots could fly at Mach 5 or faster, 3,800 miles per hour. The laboratory built new wind tunnels capable of conducting research at velocities from below the speed of sound up to Mach 7, a tunnel so fast it was labeled hypersonic. The engineers and mathematicians like Dorothy and Mary sharpened their pencils and got to work to try to figure out how to send humans flying through the air at speeds that even a decade before would have been unimaginable. The communist threat. On April 5, 1951, the same day that Mary Jackson started her job at Langley, a New York federal court handed down a death sentence against Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, a couple accused of spying for the Russians. The Rosenberg trial sparked widespread fears that communist sympathizers, people who believed in communism, Russia's political system, were living inside the United States and plotting to overthrow the American government. At Langley, the Rosenberg trial and its repercussions hit close to home. An engineer was accused of stealing classified National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics documents and giving them to the Soviet Union. Some of the stolen secrets included plans for a nuclear-powered airplane and designs for parts of a high-speed aircraft. The engineer was eventually cleared of spying charges, but he was convicted of lying about his relationship with the Rosenbergs. Suddenly, Americans were afraid that there might be spies all around them, even in their neighborhoods or at work. The FBI interviewed Langley employees. Many workers were terrified of the investigators, who sometimes came to their homes unannounced. While no one was above suspicion, the investigators focused their attention on anyone involved with organizations that the government had decided were dangerous. The FBI accused people involved with many organizations of being sympathetic to the communists and their beliefs. The fear of communism ruined many lives and livelihoods, even when people were innocent. Virginia's Senator Harry Byrd, the same politician who had criticized the Fair Employment Practices laws from World War II, stirred up another frenzy by labeling anyone who disagreed with his view of traditional American values as a communist. But President Harry S. Truman saw a different way to deal with communism. He wanted to show that the United States version of democracy was the best system in the world, encouraging developing countries, including many in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, to become American allies. To prove that America was trying to be more fair to people with dark skin, President Truman desegregated the military, allowing blacks and whites to serve side by side in the armed forces. Truman also made the head of each federal department personally responsible for maintaining a work environment free of discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, or national origin. Was discrimination taking place at Langley? On the one hand, the black women were still racially segregated into the West Computing Office. The laboratory has one work unit composed entirely of Negro women, the West Area Computers, which may fall into the category of a segregated work unit, wrote one of Langley's administrative officers in a 1951 memo. However, the memo continued, a large percentage of employees are usually detailed to work in non-segregated units for periods of 1 to 3 months. Over time, women like Dorothy Hoover, West Computing's other Dorothy, had begun to leave the computing pool and go to work in other offices, sitting next to white engineers and computers. The women knew that the best way to fight discrimination at work was to do their work as well as they possibly could. The mathematical equations didn't care what color they were, as long as the answers were correct. Chapter 11. The Area Rule. In the early 1950s, Dorothy Vaughan and the women working in the West Computing Office were always busy. Most days they worked in their own office, but sometimes other groups at the laboratory asked Dorothy to send one of her mathematicians over to their offices when the engineers needed extra help. One day, a group on the east side asked for help, and Dorothy decided to send Mary Jackson. Mary went over to the new office where she was to work with several white computers. Since Mary's office was on the west side, she wasn't familiar with all of the buildings on the east side. At some point during the day, she needed a break and asked her co-workers, "Can you direct me to the bathroom?" They giggled. How would they know where to find her bathroom? The nearest women's bathroom was open to the white women, but not to Mary, because she was black. There were colored bathrooms somewhere on the east side, but Mary didn't know where. She stormed off to look on her own. Negotiating racial boundaries was a daily task for African Americans. Mary was used to it, but something about the incident really bothered her. She was just as smart and just as talented as her co-workers. The Langley employee badge supposedly gave Mary access to the same workplace as her white co-workers. She came to work with the same education, maybe even more. She dressed each day as if she were on her way to a meeting with the president. She was a professional. Mary Jackson was angered, no, enraged, to have been confronted with such blatant prejudice in a workplace dedicated to scientific and rational thought, and she considered it absurd to be singled out for something as common and universal as going to the bathroom. In the moment that her white co-workers laughed at her, Mary had been demoted from professional mathematician to second-class human being. An unexpected offer. Still angry as she walked back to West Computing later that day, Mary Jackson ran into the assistant section head at the 4-foot by 4-foot supersonic pressure tunnel, 4-foot SPT, a powerful wind tunnel located on the west side. Most African Americans were automatically careful about how they spoke around whites, wearing a mask that kept them from saying what they really meant. Mary let her mask slip when the engineer asked her how she was doing. Unable to control her anger, she let off steam and ranted about the insulting way she had been treated by the women that morning. Mary was a soft-spoken person, but she was also direct and forthright. She was a good judge of character, and she sensed that she could trust the engineer. She picked the right person to talk to. He didn't think her feelings were unreasonable or unjustified. "Why don't you come work for me?" he asked. He respected her as a person and admired her work as a mathematician. He knew she would be an asset to his team. Mary accepted his offer. She transferred over to his research team, working with the SPT, one of the best tunnels for testing airplanes flying faster than the speed of sound. Theoretical engineers. While a great deal of attention was placed on the air tunnels and test flights, Langley wasn't a bad place for theoretical engineers either. A theoretical engineer is someone who works with numbers and papers, designing aircraft based on ideas or theories, rather than using experiments and testing. Dorothy Hoover, who had started working in West Computing the same year as Dorothy Vaughan, continued to thrive in her division, earning the title of aeronautical research scientist, a high ranking for a woman of any color. In 1951, she published two reports, both detailed analyses of the swept-back wings that were now standard in aircraft. What the wind tunnel and fresh air engineers examined through direct observation, the theoreticians approached through complex math. They prepared 50-page papers where a single equation might take up most of an entire page. Dorothy Hoover and at least three other women working in this group published research reports between 1947 and 1951. The group leaders clearly valued and cultivated the talent of its female members. In 1952, Dorothy Hoover decided to take a leave of absence from engineering to go back to school. She resigned from Langley and returned to academic life at Arkansas Agricultural Mechanical and Normal College, where she earned a master's degree in mathematics. Mary Jackson, on the other hand, threw herself into her work with her engineering team. She loved rolling up her sleeves and working with airplane models so she could understand the physical phenomena behind the calculations she worked on. Like many other former computers, she was on her way to becoming a Langley lifer, someone who stayed with the agency for her entire career. The numbers don't lie. Soon after becoming a mathematician with the supersonic pressure tunnel, Mary Jackson was given an assignment by her boss's boss's boss, a division chief, one of the laboratory's top-ranking managers and most respected researchers. He gave her instructions for working through a set of calculations. She did the work and delivered the finished assignment after double-checking her results. Something didn't seem right to the manager who assigned the work. He insisted that Mary's calculations were wrong. Mary Jackson respectfully stood by her work. Mary and the division chief reviewed the numbers and finally discovered that the problem wasn't with her output, but with his input. He had given her the wrong numbers to use. Based on those numbers, Mary's calculations were indeed correct. When they realized the mistake, he apologized to her. Mary's willingness to stand by her work earned her a reputation around the office as a smart and dedicated mathematician. Most engineers were good mathematicians, but for the most part, it was the women who knew how to work with the numbers. They were the experts. They checked each other's work and put red dots on the data sheets when they found errors. There were very, very few red dots. Some of the women were capable of lightning-fast mental math. Others had a highly refined understanding of theoretical math. The best of the women made names for themselves for accuracy, speed, and insight. But having the independence of mind and strength of personality to defend your work in front of the most powerful aeronautical minds in the world, that's what got you noticed. That's what marked you as someone who should move ahead. That was Mary Jackson. Chapter 12. An Exceptional Mind. Like Mary Jackson, Catherine Goebel was a gifted mathematician who put her talents to work as a teacher. She was quite content with her life as a wife and mother, teaching math and French in Marion, Virginia. It would be years before she learned of the work being done at the NACA in Hampton. But everything would change in August 1952, when she attended a family wedding. At the wedding, Catherine's husband's brother-in-law told Catherine that the government was hiring black women to work as mathematicians at Langley. He knew she had studied mathematics in college and graduate school. He was the director of the Newsome Park Community Center, where Dorothy Vaughn and her family lived. He knew Dorothy had quite a few of the women working for her in West Computing. Catherine listened carefully. She and her husband were public school teachers with modest paychecks. They had three daughters and had to manage their budget carefully to cover all of their family's needs. She enjoyed teaching and felt a sense of responsibility to advance the race by giving her students the best possible education, even though they attended segregated schools with fewer resources. But now, the mention of the opportunity at Langley reminded her of something she had almost forgotten. The dream of being a professional mathematician. After many years, it looked as if that dream just might come true. A mind for math. Catherine's father was a math whiz. Though educated only through the sixth grade, he could tell how much lumber a tree would yield just by looking at it. From the time she was a toddler, Catherine's parents realized that she had inherited her father's mind for math. Catherine, the youngest of four children, counted whatever crossed her path, dishes, steps, and stars in the sky. She excelled in school, especially in math. Whenever her teachers noticed that Catherine's desk was empty, they would look for her in the classroom next door, where they would find her helping her older brother with his math lesson. Catherine graduated from high school at age 14. In 1933, She enrolled at West Virginia State Institute, a black college outside Charleston. By her junior year, she had tackled every math course the school offered, so her math professor created special advanced math classes just for her. "You would make a good research mathematician," her professor told Catherine when she was a sophomore. "I'm going to prepare you for this career." He believed in Catherine and her special ability, even though job prospects were poor. In the 1930s, employers openly discriminated against Irish and Jewish women with math degrees. The odds of a black woman finding work as a mathematician were especially low. After graduation, Catherine took a job teaching at the high school in Marion, Virginia. She met Jimmy Goble, and they fell in love and married, but they kept their marriage secret. Catherine loved teaching, but at the time, the law didn't allow married women in the classroom as teachers. Unusually capable. In the spring of 1940, at the end of a busy school day, Catherine was surprised to find the president of her former college waiting outside her classroom. He said he had a special opportunity for her. Because no graduate programs were offered at any black colleges in the state, the all-white West Virginia University could be forced to admit African Americans to their graduate programs in order to comply with a Supreme Court order. If a state didn't operate a separate graduate school for black students, it would be required to integrate its existing graduate schools. Since there were no graduate programs for black students in the entire state of West Virginia, the law said that the white school had to open its doors to blacks. The governor of West Virginia didn't want to fight the law. Instead, he planned to integrate the state's public graduate schools. He asked for the names of three unusually capable West Virginia State College graduates who might be willing to desegregate the university. Catherine was asked to be one of the three. The other two were men who would be entering the law school. Catherine accepted a place in the graduate school studying mathematics. On her last day teaching at the high school, Catherine's principal presented her with a full set of math reference books. He wanted her to succeed, and he feared that, as one of the school's first black students, she might have trouble accessing the books she needed at the white school's library. Catherine enrolled in West Virginia University's summer session. Her mother moved to Morgantown, West Virginia, to room with her daughter, hoping to help her navigate what could be a difficult situation if the white students chose to bully her or call her names. As it turned out, most of the white students welcomed Catherine, and some went out of their way to be friendly. Only one classmate gave her any trouble, and that student just tried to insult Catherine by ignoring her. The professors treated her fairly, and Catherine more than met the academic standard. Her greatest challenge? Finding a course that didn't repeat what she had already learned. At the end of the summer session, Catherine found that she and her husband were expecting a baby. Being quietly married was one thing, but having a baby was another. Catherine and her husband announced the news to her family, who were overjoyed, although they realized that she was going to have to leave school. Catherine became a full-time wife and mother. She and Jimmy eventually had three daughters. She never regretted putting the family life ahead of graduate school. In 1944, Catherine took a teaching job at the local black high school to help support her family. She remained at that job until she learned about the opportunity at Langley in 1952. A new life. After listening to their brother-in-law describe the job at Langley, Catherine and her husband Jimmy decided to take the leap and move to Newport News. When they arrived, they moved into an apartment in Newsom Park. Her husband got a stable, well-paid job as a painter at the Newport News shipyard. Their three children loved their new school and marveled at being part of such a large and dynamic black community. Langley's personnel department approved Catherine's job application as a computer in 1952, but she didn't start work until June 1953. In the meantime, she worked as a substitute math teacher at the high school, which allowed her to meet a lot of families in the area. She was involved with her sorority and her church. She developed a social network and met the woman who would become a lifelong best friend, Eunice Smith, who lived 3 blocks away and was a 9-year veteran at West Computing. When Catherine started work, she and Eunice decided to drive to the office together. It was a great surprise for